Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 43. On this episode, we are talking about Big Hero 6. I think a lot of you are familiar with this movie because based on the box office numbers, lots of you went to see it. Not only did you go see it, but you also took your children to see it. So, to help us talk about it, we have Josh Crabb back, we have Laura Fissel, people that you're probably familiar with if you listen to the show at all. And we're going to talk about this movie, which is the first marriage of Disney and Marvel. And since this is Disney animation, we're of course going to be talking about kids' movies in general. We're going to be talking about the importance of when, or maybe when you shouldn't, take your kids to the movies. And we try to beat around that bush that is the unsaid thing that maybe you can't talk to kids about movies, or maybe some people use movies or films as babysitters for their children, when in fact, possibly the most important demographic to engage our children. They have some of the best observations, some of the best questions. So, because of that, we talk about healing, empathy, revenge, and get to a couple listener questions, specifically dealing with forgiveness, which is all over this movie. In all, a great show. So, here it is, episode 43, Big Hero 6, and the healing power of empathy. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Like, you have children, so you're watching probably more animated movies than the average adult.
Oh man, yeah, sometimes I feel like when I post, because I'm really honest about what I watch on Letterboxd, because I know that some people might be I'm not gonna watch that. And like, you know, I think the other week I was partially embarrassed, but at the time I thought it was the coolest thing ever to put up, like, that I watched Barbie Princess and the Pop Star with my girls. And
I noticed that, and I was like, I don't know why.
And I was like, I did not, I think in my little, like, short review I said, like, I have, you know, the courage to be able to tell my girls that this movie is not very good, and they don't appreciate that one bit. But yeah, I mean, gosh, probably most of the movies that we have actual physical DVD copies of are animated, you know, such and such movies, like everything from Tinkerbell to all the Disney movies to those Barbie movies to, you know, I mean, yeah, it's, we've got tons of them. And so,
how do you get the Barbie movies, though?
You just buy, like, them in the store.
Are y'all actually buying the Barbie movies?
No, they're like, you know, Christmas presents from grandma or whatever, aunts or something like that.
We're just trying to figure out what level of judgment we should be giving you as a parent.
You know? Hey, no judgment here. I've watched like almost all of them.
I have no shame when it comes to my girls and the movies they watch. Like it's a little bit different. I'm grateful for my oldest because she's very excited about Star Wars, and she's almost eight. She turns eight next week, and so she loves Star Wars Rebels, and we've been watching that together like every single week, and it's been really exciting. And I think that's like, if I can turn them on to something that's a little bit more cultural savvy and is kind of an excuse for a 30-year-old man to watch a kid's show, I would do that. So I mean, I'm not buying Barbie Princess and the Pop Star for them. I'm trying to shove other things on them that's a little bit of a higher echelon in quality.
Well, so how many of your children would you take to the actual theater? Like, what age do you think that that's to do that?
I don't know. I think if it was early enough, I would take three of them, my 8-year-old, my 6-year-old, and my 4-year-old. I think the 4-year-old would be okay unless there was anything really super loud. She doesn't really like loud noises. So, she tends not to like loud theaters. Mm-hmm. So I probably that's just like a her thing. That's been pretty much all of our kids. For some reason, all of our children, and I remember doing this when I was a kid too. Like, I hated fireworks when I was a kid. Like, I used to scream during fireworks, and now I think loud noises are great. But you know, when I was younger, loud noises weren't so great. And but I would definitely take the 8-year-old and the 6-year-old. Like, I don't know. I might have to have a lightsaber duel with my wife over taking the kids to episode 7 next year. Because I really want them to be able to experience it. Because I never got to experience the original trilogy in the theaters.
Mm-hmm. And even when they put them back out?
No, I don't. No, I want to say.
You didn't get to see when they redid them or whatever?
I want to say that I probably did see one of them. Because I want to say I remember sitting behind someone dressed as a stormtrooper at a movie theater.
Which we could have really been any number of movies.
No, you're right. I'm thinking back, and I do remember seeing at least one of them. Because I remember there were a lot of people dressed up in Star Wars costumes when I went to see one. You know, and obviously I got to experience the prequel trilogy in theaters. But that's not the same as seeing the original trilogy in the theaters. So,
yeah.
But let's not turn this into a Star Wars podcast yet.
Well, no. But it's not really still, because when you say you're going to have a lightsaber fight, is that because she doesn't want you to take the children, or because you have to figure out which one of you gets to do it?
No, I wish that was the case. I think it would be just because, like, Star Wars has a lot of elements in it that could potentially be frightening for younger kids, and our kids tend to be kind of sensitive to that. But I think that by then I'll have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, and I think the 7-year-old boy, my son Micah, will really, I think he'll be fine and he'll really enjoy it.
Yeah.
I don't think that she realizes how kid friendly those movies are going to be. I really think that it's probably going to be a lot more kid friendly than people think it is, or maybe like 40 and 50-year-old guys hope it will be. They're hoping, you know, it'll be all super dark and everything, but I really don't think that it's going to be super dark. Just like Rebels is a very light, fun show. I think that it's going to be the same thing. So, you know, I think it's just like it with movies like that are going to be like movies that are made for kids, but they're also trying to tip their hat to, you know, people that have been Star Wars fans since, you know, 1977. That there could be some fear there with like a movie. I mean, I don't know what a good comparison movie would be. Like, because I wouldn't take the kids to see like Avengers, because that's kind of crazy loud. Yeah. And a little bit different. It's a little bit different movie. I'm trying to think of a good like comparison movie franchise.
I was going to say this. How many movies have you probably taken your kids to this year?
Not many.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that, I mean, this goes back into the schedule thing we were talking about before. Like, we didn't have a lot of time to go see movies with the kids. And if I take kids, I could only take the older two, because the younger two wouldn't be able to go. So a lot of times it can be just a logistical nightmare. But you know, I think I'll probably take them to go see Big Hero 6. I ended up seeing it by myself instead of seeing it with them.
Because
we were going to go, and then some stuff came up and we weren't able to go. I wasn't able to take them, so I had to go without them to go see Big Hero 6.
So you're just the single, almost middle-aged man sitting in a kids' movie by himself? That's not creepy.
No, it really wasn't at all. At least that's what I'm telling myself.
Is this just a kids' movie? I don't even really think of this as a kids' movie. I don't think of a lot of recently animated films as kids' movies.
Well, and that's something that I wanted to kind of talk about a little bit later, because kind of my line of questioning is, we don't have kids, so it's always interesting to see where people draw the line of when they take their kids, when they don't take their kids. People who are very thoughtful about what they take their children to, people who basically use it as a babysitter,
right,
while they go somewhere else.
Yeah.
People who don't really take into consideration what the children probably should handle at different ages, not just from like a foul language, you know, mature content area, but just like the loudness, the immersion, the fact that if you take them to certain movies, they're going to be inundated with consumerism to want to buy everything about certain things. So people, I mean, people have different levels of concern. So I'm always interested to see where people fall on that, because I think they have I think the people who are making animated movies specifically are doing a really, really good job of making movies that parents can enjoy too. So it's becoming less and less about, well, I guess I'll go suffer just because my kid wants to see the whatever. They're like, oh, I'm going to go see this movie because my kid's going to laugh and I'm going to laugh. And we're going to be laughing at the same time, but we're probably going to be laughing for two separate reasons, mm-hmm. which is always great.
For sure.
But you did just see Big Hero 6, and you are going to take at least two of your children to see it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was surprisingly very tame for mm-hmm. what maybe you could expect. But, I mean, it's Disney. Disney does a really good job of, you know, it's not like Shrek, where at times you're like, oh, I don't know about that. Like, you know, because, I mean, Shrek was kind of like the ultimate example of, like, really making, like, all getting up to that line of, like, you know, tipping their hat to parents, like, we know you're here too, and here's a joke for you. And so, you know, yeah, I'll definitely take my kids to it. So, I couldn't imagine why parents would shy away from taking their kids to see it, unless they have kids that, you know, like I said, with our 4-year-old, would just not like the loud noise and would probably mm-hmm. freak out, and it would ruin the experience for the other two and for myself, obviously, because we'd have to leave, because she would just be screaming and ruin it for everyone else that's at the theater too, because she'd be like, I don't like it, you know, and she'd just be screaming about it and want to leave.
And you never want to be the parent of that child.
No, you know, and it really can differ from kid to kid. Like, we have friends mm-hmm. that they used to take their daughter now is 14, but when she was a baby, you know, they used to take her to the movie theater and she would sleep through the movies they watched.
Nice. Like,
how is that even possible? Like, our kids wake up when we breathe too loud. And so, you know, it's all based on the temperament of the kid, where, you know, I mean, some kids can handle that kind of stuff and some kids can't. And mm-hmm. that's kind of a decision that has to come down to parents while still being wise about the choices that you're making. Like, I went to see Guardians of the Galaxy with a bunch of friends, and I'm watching the movie. I got there like a little bit late, so I like roll in like almost right when the movie's starting, which seems to be my MO. I never make it on time for any movie in the theaters anymore.
You're like Flash.
I just show up and like, hey guys, I'm here. Is it starting? I brought popcorn. but I watched the movie, and then at the end of the movie, after we stood up and the lights came on, I looked down, and one of my friends had brought his grandson. He was 7. And I was like, what is he doing here? And I just, you know, I didn't say anything at the time, but I'm like, man, I don't know if that was the best choice with a movie like Guardians of the Galaxy, because that, I mean, whatever, but I just, you know, I wouldn't take my 8-year-old to see Guardians of the Galaxy. Also because she would make me feel incredibly guilty, because throughout the movie she would be like, he said a bad word again. And I would be like, sorry. So
stop telling me what I've taught
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, I affectionately call my older two the stupid police, because if you say the word stupid around them, they will go, you can't say that, you said stupid. And they say it during shows and stuff like that, and it's pretty funny. So my kids are my morality police, I guess, when it comes to movies and TV.
You're like, stop it, you little Pharisees.
Pretty much.
So not having children, I always feel very careful. Like, I want to walk on eggshells when we kind of push this view, mm-hmm. but especially ever since the beginning or the inception of this podcast or the inception of us really critically watching movies and realizing how much influence they have in culture, I have been a huge proponent of, okay, I'm not going to sit here and try to police what you watch with your children or what you don't watch with your children. That's got to be something as a parent you have to decide. But what I will always try to get you to think about is why, and why you're doing it, and then are you following up with your child? Are you debriefing after the movie? Like, just talk to them.
Yeah.
So, which is why I prefer them to actually see the movie as well, so they at least they can talk more intelligently. And if you don't, for some reason, see it, you know, you send them to someone else's house and they watch a movie and they come home, oh, we watched The Thing About the Thing. And you're like, oh, The Thing About the Thing, I saw a preview for that. Did you like it? You know, what was it about? What did you get from it? Just follow up. Just have conversations with your children, because they're learning things from these movies. Mm-hmm. And I just hope they're being engaged, because lots of times when we start talking about film and theology or cultural engagement and stuff, I think the thoughts go to like adults being like sitting around being like, let me have a deep conversation about this cultural thing.
For sure.
And there is obviously some of that,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but it's also about engaging people who are just being bombarded with the stuff on a daily basis. And kids, they see tons of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they're way more impressionable and likely to change their mind about something than we are. You know, because adults are often
maybe more likely to pick up on some things that are happening.
Well, yeah. I even think in relation to, I mean, we'll I guess we'll get into Big Hero 6 in a minute, right? But I even think, like, because I do Bible stories with the kids, and we're engaging in that story and talking about those stories. And you know, when I read my Bible to them, there are some pretty horrible, offensive things in the Bible at times. Mm-hmm. And we don't tend to really talk about those kind of things. And you know what I always go to when we're watching TV shows or movies or whatever is asking the same kind of questions we would ask as we go through the Bible. You know, like the same questions that I ask when I sit down, like I watch Big Hero 6 and I have a pile of questions that I ask about the movie when I'm done. And I think that if we can't ask our kids those same questions and we can't ask ourselves those same questions, like what are we really doing when we're engaging entertainment and when we're engaging TV or movies or whatever? Like if we can ask those same questions that we ask from the Bible that we ask of Big Hero 6 or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or Star Wars Rebels or whatever, like we can ask those questions and draw those things out of the story and get the kids to think about what they're watching. And it's not just specific to adults. You know, I always think of like, if you can't communicate a concept to like a kid level, like an adult's never going to be able to really grasp it either. And it's not a simple concept. So mm-hmm. like, you know, I mean, I'm going to be doing this kind of stuff all the time. Like my new job, my new official title as a pastor at Appleton Gospel is the pastor of adult and family discipleship. And so it's like, I'm going to be going through and talking to families and praying for them and figuring out how, you know, they can transfer the truth of the Bible into their family lives and to be able to disciple one another and for dads and moms to be able to disciple their kids. And this is a big component of it, I think, like, because what are kids doing more than anything besides like when they come home? Like what's our routine when we come home is like we eat dinner, we do homework, and then we watch a TV show, and then we do the Bible and pray and go to bed. And so it's like, why would I let them have that time where it's like, okay, for this next half hour, I'm going to let the TV talk to you, and we're never mm-hmm. going to talk about what you just watched.
Yeah. It's not related to your spiritual life, or it doesn't have anything to do with anything else in your life. It's just like a time where you...
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, the kids don't always appreciate it. Like, sometimes they'll ask questions and, you know, like, my 6-year-old will give me a smart aleck remark because that's just who he is. But a lot of times I can get them talking and they'll say a lot of really smart, in-depth things that, like, I don't hear from adults when they watch TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, the kids will have some penetrating insight about something, and it's like I'll ask somebody about like, oh, why do you watch The Walking Dead? And they're like, oh, because zombies' heads explode, you know, like that's the best you're gonna get out of them, and that just doesn't make any sense to me. And you know, I guess it has to do with why, you know, we are doing what we do,
or at least I hope.
Yeah for sure. But you know, I think with movies for adults, movies for kids, you know, I mean, you can ask very deep questions about the stories that you watch and the stories that we hear and listen to, and you can grab some really insightful things, and I think kids can learn from it and adults can learn from it.
Well, let's transition into asking some of those good questions.
Okay.
By talking about Big Hero 6, and I'm gonna do a misdirect real quick, because I'm gonna basically introduce Big Hero 6, but then I'm gonna stop talking about Big Hero 6.
Okay.
Because that's what I do, and I want to frame this in the context that so Big Hero 6 is a film by Disney Animation. This is like the revival of Disney Animation. Like there was a lull there for quite a while, but then John Lasseter. And another guy that I should remember went and basically took from Pixar, basically went and took over Disney Animation. And ever since then, they've slowly rebuilt it. And then we've gotten Wreck-It Ralph, which has been, you know, widely acclaimed,
mm-hmm.
and Frozen, which was obnoxiously popular, you know, and incredibly a hit last year. A surprise, considering how it was marketed and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they had kind of a triple and a grand slam, and I think they've probably hit another home run here based on how people are reacting to it, reviews. Like I said, just how it's kind of penetrating the culture of those who have seen it and are spreading the word of it, because mm-hmm. I think it's going to continue to make money. I mean, it beat out Interstellar its opening weekend.
Yeah,
which
I kind of figured, but
you figured that? I didn't see that coming.
Well, so people said it was because Interstellar had bad pre-screening press,
mm-hmm.
because people were like, "Oh, it's pretty good, but it's not amazing." Mm-hmm. I was like, "I don't think that had anything to do with it." Anytime you have a good animated movie.
It's gonna win out.
It's PG.
Yeah.
So you have adults that might be interested in seeing it, parents that could go see it, and then everybody from age, you know, 5 to on up who can be a paying customer to see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Interstellar, you have to be in the know. You have to know who Christopher Nolan is. You have to be just a film fan in general, and you have to be able to typically go see a rated R movie. So your audience is just narrow.
Well, plus it's a specific genre. And so only certain people are interested in science fiction. And which, ironically enough, I would consider Big Hero 6 science fiction in many ways. But it's still going to have a much broader audience, because I feel like genre doesn't drive an animated film. You know, like setting isn't going to drive an animated film and who sees it as much as other films.
Well, and not typically, but if historically, if you look back at the top grossing films every year, if you look at the top like 20 or 25 grossing films, I would say lots of times a half to two thirds of those films are all going to be the animated movies,
mm-hmm.
whether they were good movies or not.
Yeah.
And most of the rest of the movies are actually going to have been some of the best movies that came out that year, or the biggest blockbusters. So I almost always bet on animated movies, especially when it has Disney's name behind it,
mm-hmm.
or when it has, you know, Marvel's name attached to it. So I had a hunch. I wasn't sure. I probably wouldn't have bet my own money on it, but I was not surprised at all.
Did Josh, do you read comic books?
Not really anymore.
Yeah. So you're not familiar with these characters from comics?
Well, even I think the thing is this wasn't really like, it was kind of more an obscure property of Marvel's.
Okay.
Because I think that Marvel, when Disney, John Lasseter, I guess, just, or the team that was putting it together, just, they were like, I guess they were intrigued by the name Big Hero 6 and then looked into it a little more and then like talked to Marvel about it. And Marvel was like, oh, mm-hmm. that's a property of ours? Like, we had no idea it was even a, apparently, I guess that was the whole story, is that Marvel was kind of oblivious to the fact that they actually had Biggest Hero 6 as like a as an IP. And so I think that's why they gave Disney such a wide swath to be able to sort of recreate a bunch of the characters. And, you know, because I think the cast or the Big Hero 6, the six heroes, some of the main heroes of the original comic book aren't even in this movie.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. So what Big Hero 6 is supposed to be, according to Disney, is an action-packed comedy adventure about the special bond that develops between Baymax, a plus-size inflatable robot, and prodigy Hero Hamada. When a devastating event befalls the city of San Francisco, that's really hard to say.
It's a mouthful.
It is so hard to say.
Say five times fast.
Yeah, San Francisco. And catapults Hero into the midst of danger. He turns to Baymax and his close friends, adrenaline junkie Gogo Tamago, Neat Nick Wasabi, chemistry whiz Honey Lemon, and fanboy Fred. Determined to uncover the mystery, Hero transforms his friends into a band of high-tech heroes called Big Hero 6. And reading that and thinking that Disney's going to make an anime movie, I was like, well, that sounds like it's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best part about Big Hero 6 is that it's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But before, gosh, before we get into that, I want to take just a minute or two to basically get you guys' thoughts on the movie before the movie, Feast.
Oh.
The animated short beforehand.
This misdirect is so unexpected.
Is it? Curse your sudden but inevitable misdirect. So Josh, like, did you get there in time to see?
I did. And I got it. Well done. I got to tell you, I got home from Big Hero 6, and Tina, my wife, asked me what you know how it was, and I said, Tina, the 5-minute movie beforehand was incredible, and I might have liked it more than Big Hero 6. And it got to the end of it, and I don't it was oh man, it was so good that I kind of had to like hold back tears and like, get a hold of yourself, man. You got a whole movie to review here. And then it was just like, no, man, you just got to let it go. And so I just cried before the big episode started. And I got home and I described it, the whole like sort of, you know, the structure and what happens in the thing. And I'm like choking up telling Tina about it. Because, man, it was so good. And it was just a cool, neat, compact little story that packed such an emotional punch. And I don't know, maybe it's just because like I'm a softie, but you know, like just the ending of the movie, I thought it was so good. And it was so neat that they were able to communicate such powerful emotions with not a single word in the I think like just only kind of like maybe a stray word or two from the adults that you or the humans that you can't see on screen.
Yeah, no direct dialogue.
Right, right.
But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so cool looking, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the art was beautiful.
Yeah.
So this is why I took this detour, mm-hmm. because I think this is well worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get passed over. Because, Laura, did you like that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, now I feel like I'm a downer after Josh like gushing about it because I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say that like this blew me out of the water more than any of the others, but I always enjoy the, you know, the pre-show. Yeah, it was very engaging, and just the storytelling was remarkable, as it typically is. You know, they do such an incredible job with that, those. But yeah, I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I liked it a lot because for the first time, I really felt that the story that was told through this puppy,
mm-hmm.
who loved to eat terrible things. well, and I say terrible things, but I mean amazing things.
Yeah.
You know, like junk food or, you know, things that aren't good for you, bachelor food. And then is upset because he has to eat health food, or basically doesn't eat health food, and is always hungry because his owner ends up starting to date a health nut, I guess.
Or just a regular woman.
Or just a regular woman.
Does she have to be a health nut to not let him eat, like, donuts every night?
Exactly. Okay. You have to be crazy.
Gotcha.
You have to be, like, some kind of health, like, Nazi. So, you know, seeing the you know, seeing what the dog was doing, but then eventually letting the dog turn to see the world around him, and that he was focused on himself, but then once he was able to kind of, like, have empathy for someone else, it kind of changed his worldview and his priorities. And I felt like that was a great setup emotionally to take us into Big Hero 6. So another another reason I wanted to kind of mention this as well, because I'd never noticed the correlation, or if they'd actually thought that much about the correlation of the pre-film, the short film, with the actual full-length feature. But to me, like, this understanding or realization of empathy, like I said, leads right into Big Hero 6. Mm-hmm. And I didn't cry at the end of the short film. But it really packed a punch, and like I said, I think set me up to be in the right emotional state for Big Hero 6. So I wanted to kind of give, like, a kudos, and, you know, if you're going to see Big Hero 6 and you're listening to this, I would say make sure you show up in time, because Feast is what it's called. The short film is definitely worth seeing, and I'm interested to see if it, you know, qualifies for, like, the best animated short film, like, come Oscar season, because, you know, you hardly ever get to see any of these beforehand, unless you go to, like, all the Oscar
screening, like we do.
Screening, like we do, typically. But, to Big Hero 6, so, we know, Josh, we know how you feel about how you feel about Feast. We know that you were blubbering full. So, Big Hero 6, finally, like a half hour in. How did you enjoy this movie?
I really liked it. I really enjoyed it. It was fun. It was super funny. I thought the beginning of it was, especially the first half of the movie, was some of the best, like, physical kind of comedy that you've seen in, like, almost anything in a really long time. It was it was just really, really entertaining, and the interaction and just the funny parts between Baymax and Hero in the movie are just fantastic and so funny and so clever. And I thought that first part of the movie, especially when it was more focused on the two of them interacting and was really focused on Baymax and Hero, is where I thought that the movie really shined as far as a comedic, from a comedic standpoint. But then the second half of the movie, I thought, kind of turned into, like, an Avengers type movie. It was very much like, you know, it was very action packed, very fast paced, you know, just clipping along towards the end of the movie. But it was a really enjoyable experience. I really liked it. There's very few movies where I laugh out loud. Especially, like, even here at home, where it's, like, safe to laugh out loud and no one's going to care.
It just doesn't bring it out of you.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that it would be okay. Like, here, I'd probably laugh a lot more if I'm here at home by myself. But, like, at a movie theater, I'd maybe be a bit more reserved, especially when there was probably maybe only about 12 people in the theater when I saw it. So it would just be, like, you don't want to be that guy that's, like, laughing out loud. But, but there were some moments in that movie where I laughed out loud because it was that funny. And that's saying something about the movie when, you know, you can get someone to just sort of, like, cast aside the fact that you're in a theater with not a lot of other people and you're able to laugh about it. Yeah, and it was just a really enjoyable movie. I thoroughly thought it was fun. You know, I really want to take my kids to see it. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to say about it except that I really, really enjoyed this movie. And
how do you think it compares to some of the other animated movies that have come out this year, as far as, you know, quality and stuff?
Compared to movies this year, I don't think that it's as good as the Lego Movie. I think the Lego Movie is kind of in rarefied air as far as a movie. I haven't seen How to Train Your Dragon 2. I've heard good things about that movie.
I hear there's a good podcast about that movie.
I hear I've heard such things as that too. You know, we were just talking about this, and now I can't remember any of the animated movies from 2014 anymore.
Well, there's two really recent ones that we haven't actually had a chance to see yet: The Book of Life and Box Trolls.
Box Trolls, right. Mm-hmm.
Both of which were fairly well reviewed, but didn't really do a lot in the theater, which is kind of surprising.
Yeah, I think the only movie that I would say that'd be better than this one is the Lego Movie. You know, because I think like Rio 2, and I've seen like The Nut Job and all those other movies, and they're just not nearly as good as this movie is.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That's still high praise. Because like I said, the Lego Movie, I think, has set the bar pretty high.
Yeah.
So Laura, when you left this movie, how did it strike you?
All the things Josh said.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, for me...
Except I would add that I was really captivated by the art, and also it really just like grabbed my sci-fi loving heart because of all the gadgets and experimentation and new technology, and it's just fun to see all that. I love that in some of the reviews I was reading, I love that they mentioned that this could be a film that really encourages kids who are interested in exploring science and making scientific advancements, and like especially in light of some of the messages of like films such as Interstellar and with what's going on with NASA and our, you know, our dwindling heart for exploration and adventure. Mm-hmm. So maybe something like this can excite people to say there's still more things to be discovered. There's still more things to create. So
yeah.
I liked that a lot. And yeah, ditto about the humor. I was laughing out loud all the time. I mean, there are things that I like want to look for opportunities to quote because they're so great. So yeah, all that stuff.
All that stuff.
Yeah. I think that, and comparing it to other animated films we've seen this year, I'm really mostly thinking The Lego Movie and How to Train Your Dragon 2. And in comparison, it feels like Big Hero 6 is maybe a more simple of a story. Like, it's not as nuanced. And so maybe it doesn't reach certain levels of depth that the other films do. But it was as enjoyable to me. I mean, I would watch all three of those movies again and again. Mm-hmm. I'm excited to see this film again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think Big Hero 6 did really well was, even though it's incredibly complicated to say, San Fran, Tokyo, I think was a very cool place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This combination of Tokyo, San Francisco, you know, the Bay Area with the Tokyo, the Japanese influence.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was a very interesting culture that they basically created, this city that they kind of brought to life. Without having to take a lot of time, I think, to specifically stop and do that. So they made the world very real.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun. So that everything that happened in it just added to it. And I thought that was a great groundwork for everything that happened in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The humor, I thought, was really great. I think one of the people that I read a review from made a point that I would gladly reiterate, which is that lots of the humor in this film isn't just pop culture references.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of it's sight gags, and lots of it's applicable to the actual scene that it's from.
Mm-hmm.
So this type of humor can be funny, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
Yeah, you don't need any other reference.
Yeah, you don't have to be like, oh, mm-hmm. I don't remember that thing that was funny in pop culture that they're referencing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's all self-contained. And that typically isn't something that you see very often. So the humor was really good. The drawbacks that I saw from it were kind of like what Laura was saying. After seeing a movie like the Lego Movie, or some things that were dealt with in How to Train Your Dragon 2, some of the really hard things that were dealt with in that movie, I felt like this movie did feel a bit simple. But with that said, there's nothing wrong with simple.
No.
I felt like I could tell what was going to happen. Like, I knew who the bad guy was going to be. I knew there was going to be a misdirect, probably, for who the, you know, it turned out the ultimate villain would be in this film. But kind of like Josh, you were pointing out, most of the best stuff about this movie was the interactions between Hero and Baymax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you guys guess the ending? Or did you guys guess the villain before it even happened?
Mikey did.
Oh, yeah.
I did before the stuff got even stolen.
Yeah.
And, you know.
I had the same thing. Like, my mind was worrying, and I was like, oh, there's no way it's just going to be the guy you think it is. So it's got to be this guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was like, it totally was. And it kind of felt like you know, when they finally unmasked him, it felt like a Scooby-Doo moment almost a little bit. You know, it was like...
Oh, it definitely did. I didn't think about it that way, but yeah, that's exactly... I was like, wah, wah.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't feel surprised to find out who the villain was. It wasn't like, oh my gosh. But I wasn't... I mean, I was so distracted by everything else that was going on. I was so... And distracted is not even the word. I was so intrigued and interested in everything else that was going on.
Yeah.
That it didn't really matter to me that it was not a big reveal.
No, it didn't at the time. It just makes it kind of funny that you could see it coming, but you also didn't really care that you saw it coming. That I guess that's a testament to how good the movie was, is that you just don't care.
Well, I want to point this out, too. That was where, above anything else, above the fact that they were kind of a superhero team, that's where it felt like a Marvel movie to me. Mm-hmm. Lots of criticism that has come up against Marvel movies is that the villains are never really that villainous.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're big, they're bad, and they don't matter. Mm-hmm. Like, especially when you watch like the villains of like the Thor movies. They're like, oh man, there's this crazy, crazy villain, and he's really not in it that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And it's just something that kind of gets in the way while we're learning more about the character doing something somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I felt about the villain in Big Hero 6. And ultimately, it kind of colored how I felt about the movie, because I wanted there to be an antagonist that was truly, I don't know, not scary necessarily, because it still is an animated movie and I still want, you know, kids to be able to enjoy it, but just like the antagonist is the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, the witch is the bad guy, or, you know, the dragon is the bad guy. You know, I was hoping that the bad guy would be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't even mind it that much, because to me, the interesting thing about the villain was not that he, you know, had some crazy plan, or that he was like really evil and the stakes were really high and how are we going to defeat him. It was more, I mean, there, so I say this movie is simple, but I feel like it's because there's not a ton of stuff going on the peripheral there. Everything is very focused to me.
Oh, it's very streamlined.
Yes.
There aren't like cut scenes that are wacky and funny just to be wacky and funny.
Right. And so it's not like, it's not a simple movie that's pretending that it's complex. So throwing a ton of stuff in there to make it seem complicated when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's just a simple movie that is very focused and clear. And so to me, the interesting thing about the villain is that the villain and Hero had the same motivation for the things they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
They both were, their actions were driven by love and loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and I think that's one of the things this movie, one of the most interesting themes this movie explores, is what makes somebody a hero and somebody else the villain? You know, are we that different? And what makes us different? Or what can help us to heal so that we're not, you know, we're not destructive when we're in pain, that we can actually build, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the answer to that is community, you know, like having people that surround you that care about you, who will shut off your robot when you make it evil, who will, you know, who will come find you even when you don't answer your phone. So all of that to say that I think those are reasons why it didn't really matter to me that the villain was, you know, was telegraphed or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, like that, I make the Scooby-Doo joke about the unmasking scene, but that's kind of like one of the critical scenes in the movie for exactly what you were just talking about, because, you know, once he's unmasked, the hero's desire to sort of seek justice for the death of his brother. And I just spoiled the crap out of the movie. So if anybody hadn't seen it, it's ruined for you.
Well, I was going to say, we haven't said who the villain is. And I was trying to kind of push as far as possible just in case people did want to have like a spoiler line. But we'll go ahead and toss that out there. Like,
right.
Yeah. I think we've talked about like the general concept of the movie. I think we've talked about a lot of good things. So we'll probably really spoil stuff from here on out. Mm-hmm. Or we have the... We're opening it up to make sure that we can. So
right.
So unleash the spoilers.
Yeah, so don't worry about spoilers from now on out. And if you're listening, know that we are going to spoil some of the stuff.
Right.
Even though you might be able to see it coming a mile away. So
it may not matter.
Right, exactly. Because I think that's kind of the turning... That's sort of the divergent point in the movie for... At least in the story, the divergent point for Hero and for Callahan, Professor Callahan, who, you know, turns out to be the bad guy at that point once he's unmasked.
Dun, dun, dun.
You know, because Hero immediately, like, his eyes go red, and then he literally gets Baymax's eyes to turn red to try and kill him. You know, it's not about just getting this guy anymore or finding out who he is. It's about getting his revenge for what happened. And you know, he I like, Laura, that you already mentioned it's community, because it's really all the other heroes you know, that are with him, that that not even talk sense into him, but really just intervene when a Hero could be making a huge mistake and murdering somebody in return for, you know, taking eye for an eye. And
and intervening at great cost to themselves.
Right, exactly. Like, they all get beat up to a certain extent before they're finally able to stop him, just like right at the last second, or to stop Baymax at the last second from killing Callahan. And I like how that it's such a rich image of who we are as people. Because I think, like, I think I would make, if I was blinded by rage in a situation like that, I would feel like I would be very primal, like Hero was, just, it'd be like, this guy needs to pay for what he did to my brother. Like, you know, and then, you know, he didn't even take any responsibility for it. He just said that's his own fault for being there. Like, it was, you know, and it's just, his eyes go red and he tries to kill him, but he gets this intervening, and it's the same thing. Like, we have people around us. I think I jotted down, you know, at that point, that they kind of intervene and are seeking to restore this this sense of justice that's turned into revenge. You know, and then when they gather together after Hero's, you know, lost him and gone back to his lab to put more, you know, to get Baymax basically outfitted to be able to go after this guy again, you know, they sort of band together and they decide to work together and decide to seek, you know, reconciliation and everything. And I kind of got this idea of that, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, you know, for they shall be called children of God. I had this idea that it was community working together, that they were trying to be peacemakers of the situation and seek not revenge or to seek justice on their own, but to seek reconciliation and restoration, you know, this guy, and really just to put a stop to it. And yeah. I thought that was a really cool image of the, you know, as we as Christian people working together as the church, like we come in and we help those in need that are in those situations where we're going to sin and do some, like, hopefully we're not gearing up to kill people and we have to have somebody intervene to tell us not to kill somebody. But if it came to that, like, that's what the body of Christ is there for. It's there to intervene and to be, you know, God's people together, to be able to be his people. And I thought that was a really cool image at that point in the movie.
No, I think not only does it wrestle with things like that, but this movie also does a really great job of hitting both extremes of the, like, emotional spectrum.
Yeah.
Because you get some, I mean, you get some weighty thing. I know I mentioned, like, How to Train Your Dragon 2 earlier, like, dealing with some kind of weighty, deep, almost dark things.
Right.
But this has a lot of that. It has a lot of revenge, spitefulness. I mean, loss. I mean, Hero starts out living with his aunt. and his brother. Mm-hmm. So he's already not got any parents.
Mm-hmm.
He loses his brother fairly soon into the movie.
And I mean, those stakes are high. Like, yeah. I really felt that because, you know, when it's revealed that his brother really went in there for nothing, it makes that one thread that he's holding on to, that he was a, you know, he was a hero. He went in to selflessly to save somebody else. Mm-hmm. It makes it completely worthless. So his death is meaningless. So yeah, those stakes are really high.
Well, and not only that, but that's why I think the movie works so well, because as soon as I left the movie, I was a little bit down on it, because even though there's a lot to enjoy, I was like, oh, so predictable. Mm-hmm. But the further and further I get away, I keep remembering how much I want to see this movie again, mm-hmm. because it was so fun, and yet it still had the ability to strike that serious tone. And I don't think that serious tone would have worked very well if Professor Callahan wasn't also dealing with loss.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, you know, Professor Callahan is like the anti-hero or anything like that. He's just a dude who's lost something that's willing to do anything to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And
Hero would be if he didn't have people telling
which
him
hero would be if he didn't have the exact same thing. And I right. think that's the beauty of it. This is like any one of those, you know, like it's like a parable where you're like, I love to think that I'm this guy in the parable, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. but if I really am honest with myself, you know, I'm this guy.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I'd love to think that at the end I'm the one offering forgiveness, or I'm not the one letting revenge dictate my worldview. But honestly, most times I'm Professor Callahan,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I need someone to, I don't know, beat me up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously not physically, but
Maybe physically.
Yeah, and I think an underlying tone to the whole idea of death and loss is that death and loss is extremely isolating. And, you know, because there's that part after Tadashi dies that Hiro's basically closed himself off from everybody. You know, he gets the dinner from his aunt, and it's just replacing the dinner that he never even ate. And, you know, he's sort of rebuffing her entreaties to, you know, come down and have dinner with her, or like to watch a scary movie with her. And you know, he's even rejecting, like, he pulls up the email of all of Tadashi's friends, or it's supposed to be his friends, over at the, I mean, is it a university or a tech school, mm-hmm. or something like that?
It's not important for the point of the story.
No, it's really not. But, you know, he just closes that email and doesn't do anything. And it's really Baymax's care and, you know, caring for him that's even able to get him. Because those other heroes, like Fred and Gogo and Wasabi and Honeylemon, don't even show up, you know, until the very last second when he's trying to confront Callahan, or at the time the Kabuki bad guy, all by himself with just Baymax. Mm-hmm. And they show up at kind of the last second to rescue him from that, and from really traveling down the same path that Callahan traveled down by himself.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really interesting that they both kind of came from this place where they trusted somebody and it turned out that they weren't trustworthy, and they both wanted revenge as a result of that. You know, Hiro trusted Callahan, and then when he found out Callahan led to the death of Tadashi, he wanted revenge. And when Callahan trusted Cray is the name, Alistair Cray. He lost his daughter Abigail, supposedly.
As far as we know.
Which, by the way, just as a side note, is as a bunch of Joss Whedon fans, you know, Alan Tudyk is the voice of Alistair Cray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Alan Tudyk, who was also in Wreck-It Ralph and also in Frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm looking forward to a long career of his voice acting being in every Disney movie. Mm-hmm. Awesome. I'm definitely okay with that.
Awesome.
So I would say this too. The thing about Baymax, I mean, Baymax is instantly lovable, mm-hmm. you know,
and huggable.
I mean, exactly. Like he. But it's it's such a great, obviously embellished example of the power of empathy and to a certain degree, like self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Like I said, obviously embellished because, you know, Baymax isn't a real person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Baymax is programmed to heal and not harm. Mm. But we see the power that if your first instinct is to be a healer instead of a divider or a harmer or an instigator, like the power that you can have in someone's life, even if they don't want you to be.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Like being able to be recklessly empathetic
for sure
towards someone else.
You know, it's funny too because Hero at the beginning seems so disinterested in Baymax. But he could shut him off anytime he wants to. He knows the code and he doesn't say it.
Yeah.
So clearly there's something there that even though he wants to act like he doesn't care, he deeply cares and wants somebody like that in his life.
Well,
wow.
We're kind of getting around that time, and we did have one
long pre-show.
Yeah, a long pre-show. We had a listener question that I want to make sure we get in before we start wrapping up. Well, it's kind of a listener comment / question. It comes from Aaron White via Twitter. He asks one simple question. Like I said, followed by more of a like
that's
an explanation.
That's good. I'm simple-minded.
And we've kind of already asked this or answered this a little bit.
Okay.
But he said, "Did you cry?"
Did I cry? Oh, I have to think about that. Did I cry?
So we know, Josh. We know you cried during Feast. But did
does
but,
that count?
But did were you bawling? Because he mentions that he was bawling a couple times, or maybe I'm embellishing with saying bawling. But he said there was tears flowing a couple different times during this movie.
Yeah, I think the part that I got maybe a little bit misty at was when, you know, Baymax had said a couple of times, you know, Tadashi is here, and then when he actually like showed the video of him, there was really touching about Hero being able to see his brother putting all of that labor and work into Baymax. Mm-hmm. And I really, like, what welled up in me was sort of this idea that Baymax, as much as he cares for Hero and, you know, wants what's best, you know, he's his healthcare professional. He's there to be there for him. But he's also an extension of Tadashi's care for Hero. And, you know, he becomes a little bit of who Tadashi was to Hiro before he died. And you really get that from that scene. And that kind of made me, you know, misty-eyed as a, you know, I'm an older brother. So, you know, for me, it's like, yeah, I would hope that my brother would care if I died. you know, and saw videos of him. And I thought that was like a really cool, touching moment. But that was really the only place in the movie where I thought it really grabbed me, because I think that was the, in my opinion, was sort of the conclusion of the what I thought was like the two parts of the movie, which was like the first more Hero Baymax interaction, and then jumping into that sort of last big action part of the movie, which felt more like the Avengers to me. So I wasn't as emotionally primed for the end when Baymax sacrifices himself to be able to save Hero and Abigail than I was at that point in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So where were you at on the emotional scale, Laura?
I can't remember if I cried or not, which maybe means I didn't. But I was very touched by a lot of little moments that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Moments that happened between Tadashi and Hiro. Definitely the scene that Josh is talking about. And really many, many of the scenes in which Hiro and Baymax are just interacting. So, I mean, yeah, I was touched by Baymax explaining to Hiro, like, this, my purpose is not to, you know, it's not to hurt anyone. You know, I'm just here to help you. Mm-hmm. So it was very touching to me. I don't think I can say that I cried, though. What about you?
I did not, but I think what the scene that Josh is talking about when we got to see Tadashi through Baymax, that definitely was hitting home really hard. And I thought it was really well done, because you would expect it to be something obvious, like Tadashi talking about how much he loved Hiro just randomly, or making like a journal entry like, "Oh, my brother is out fighting robots again. I really wish he'd realize how great he is." Right. You know, like something like that.
Which would have then just been emotionally manipulative, because you know, like, "Oh, I'm supposed to feel so sad right now."
Right.
But it accomplished the same thing.
Yeah, and it had almost had nothing to do with Hiro, but it had everything to do with Hiro, or what he needed. So that, I mean, that was great. I kind of assumed this was what was going to happen, because I saw Star Trek Nemesis, but when Hiro opened Baymax's hand, or armor hand, there at the end, and the card fell out, with Baymax's basically his chip, whatever made Baymax Baymax on that card, when
Data,
that was there.
You mean
Data? Baymax? Yeah, Baymax Data, Data Max,
Data Max.
Whenever that was there, I was like, "Oh, yay!" I mean, like, you know, it was like a heartwarming thing. Like I said, again, even though I knew it was coming, I had a hunch. I guess I didn't know. Certainty is a very hard thing. It's like saying always or forever. It's very tough. But I mean, the tears never came. But like I said, I think it was really heartwarming, and I think that to me is something that still is worth mentioning. But so the follow up from Aaron, and we've kind of talked about this already, but it can kind of be like one of our final thoughts before we move into the wrap up. He said he just wanted to get our thoughts on how forgiveness plays out in the film. So Josh, how do you think forgiveness plays out in the film?
Well, I mean, I think that forgiveness, or even like the concept of mercy, is probably the strongest. One of the strongest things in the entire movie. Like you said, we already talked about that scene where the other heroes show mercy to Callahan and basically stop Baymax through Hiro killing Callahan, and, you know, showing him mercy. But, you know, forgiveness is there in that part. It's there when they forgive Hiro for almost killing Callahan. You know, there's forgiveness in Hiro forgiving Callahan for killing Tadashi to a certain extent, and not wanting to kill him in return, just wanting to take him alive. And almost like, it's not direct forgiveness, but you get the feeling that when Baymax and Hiro don't even blink an eye to go into that, you know, vortex or portal thing to go save Abigail, that there's not even a second thought that they've already forgiven and now are even seeking Callahan's restoration from all of this by going to save his daughter. And, you know, through that, Callahan might be able to forgive Cray, who possibly, or at this point, you know, she's just in a hypersleep and not dead, but just missing. But there's this really strong concept of forgiveness or mercy that runs through the entire movie, at multiple points during the movie, in my opinion. I think it's the strongest emotion that you get from both of those major scenes.
Yeah, and I think I see it a lot in the way that people come alongside Hiro throughout his development in the film. Because he's actually, I mean, he's likable because he's cool and he's a genius, and, you know, but he's kind of a punk.
Well, he's a teenager.
Yeah. And but his brother and his aunt are very merciful to him. I mean, they, instead of doing what they could do, which is say, get your act together, you know, you're going to have a horrible life, you're going to get into trouble, you might even get killed. He, especially Tadashi, just steers him in the right, you know, in the right direction by using what he knows about his brother. You know, what will what will intrigue his brother, what will change his mind. So there's just a lot of, like, people spending time to know, like, to see to the heart of Hiro, and then making choices about their behavior towards him because of that, you know? And choosing to be kind instead of, like, being harsh, you know? Mm-hmm. Or even really showing him, giving him justice for his actions, you know, making him see the consequences of his actions. So there's a lot of mercy and forgiveness, I think, in shaping Hiro into the person he is at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So some pretty deep stuff for a film that we've mostly just called simple, which is impressive.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thankful for that, though, because I think that the more overcomplicated films tend to be, I don't know, the harder it is to really connect to it, you know, because you're just kind of all over the place. So I love that about this film.
Well, I think it definitely, it makes it a great film to take kids to, because
mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be hard for them to pick up on some of this stuff and being able to have these conversations. So
no,
that's exciting.
For sure. I mean, I think even if they just get beyond the fact that they really like Baymax or whatever, you know, and that he's cute and cuddly and funny and does some really funny stuff or whatever. But, you know, even the fact that Baymax, you know, even though it's his program to care, his willingness to continue to care for Hiro when Hiro makes mistakes and all these other things, or, you know, I go back to that, you know, scene where they almost kill Callahan. Baymax is pretty much forgiving of the fact that Hiro used him to try and kill him. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's sort of this constant carer, and there's sort of just that thread of forgiveness that exists throughout the entire movie. And Baymax, it's what he's programmed to do, but, I mean, you know, it's sort of his image or who he's supposed to be is to care for Hiro no matter what. And I like how Baymax sort of embodies that caring and forgiveness at all times, regardless of what Hero's actions are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool, because I wish that I could be that, and I wish that there was someone out there that could do that for me too.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing about Baymax that I think I like so much. It's he's obviously giving us a standard of empathy
mm-hmm.
and selflessness that we can never live up to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's not something that we shouldn't try for.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. Well, okay. So to wrap up, we do what we always do and talk about something that maybe bothered us about the movie or come on kind of moment. So with this movie, like I said, I didn't think it was perfect. I thought it was really great, but there were definitely a time or two when I was like, oh, come mm-hmm. on. So Josh, where did you land on things that maybe just didn't sit quite right with you?
What I think didn't sit right with me is I was really annoyed at a certain point in the movie with Fred, TJ Miller's character. Like, I thought that there were moments that I thought he was really funny, and but there were definitely moments where I was just like, will you stop narrating everything in the movie? And that's what really annoyed me. I think there was one point, oh man, I think it was
comic books.
No, it wasn't that. It was when they were all looking at the video of, you know, what happened with the malfunction with the portal or the instant transportation technology or whatever they called it. You know, and he just, it like they were narrating what was happening, and then Fred said something. I can't even remember what it was. I wish I would have wrote it down, because it really just annoyed me. And I was like, in my head, I was like, ah, shut up. Because he just basically like stated the obvious, and it was like, oh, so now you're not Fredzilla anymore, you're Captain Obvious as a part of Big Hero 6. It was just and you know, then the part where he's like narrating his what he's doing just got really tired and overwrought for me, and it was just like, come on. Stop. But I'm going to prove to be a horrible hypocrite when we get to my favorite part of the movie, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder how long it's going to last. All right, so Laura, what was your quan moment?
I think just as a viewer, when they were doing the montage as Big Hero 6 was becoming a team and they were all getting kind of their weapons and all that kind of stuff. It's not necessarily that I had a problem with the with the science or the their ability to learn these skills. I mean, pretty much Wasabi, if he like if he's not paying attention, he's basically going to chop his own arm off and everything else that's around him. So, I mean, so a little bit of that was, to me, I was like, really? They, I mean, how long are they doing this in? Is this like a week or, and you know, they were all so distinct. Their personalities were all distinct. They were like, oh, he's like the, you know, and that felt a little bit like it was, I mean, maybe I wasn't paying attention, but it seemed like it was suddenly like their characters were being distilled right then. It was like, oh, this is this person who does this, you know, and they're really good at it. And maybe, you know, I'm going to be a hypocrite too, because their first battle, they don't really do very well. So, but anyway, it maybe that montage was a little bit too, like, too fast for me.
Too convenient. Too unbelievable. For Laura.
Too convenient.
I can just say, I can just say I'm glad with Fred that they didn't have like another comic relief in there, because then it would have felt way too much. It would have been another Scooby-Doo moment. It would have been like Shaggy and Scoob or something like that, because Fred seems so obviously like a Shaggy type character that I just thought it was. I'm just glad that there wasn't some other comic relief in that group, you know, like, you know, Wasabi.
He was enough.
Yeah, he was quite enough.
Yeah, but whenever he became his superhero persona, he was his own Scooby-Doo to his Shaggy. So he didn't need anything else.
Yeah, I think there was point where Wasabi said, like, if you don't stop, I'm going to energy knife you or something like that in the face. And I was like, yes, thank you. That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Well, when I think about the things that didn't sit right with me with this movie, honestly, there's only two real things, and they're more like overarching things, and I've mentioned both of them to a certain degree. One was that the villain was almost like a B story. It was like a side story.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's kind of a nitpicky thing, because I do love the focus on Hero and Baymax so much. The other was that I didn't write it down, so it obviously wasn't that big of a deal. So there's that.
Apparently there is another one out there somewhere.
Oh, there was another one. I thought I wrote it down. I remember thinking of two things that were... it was what I talked about earlier. It was that I felt like everything was a little too predictable. So... But, like I said, as I've gone, you know, it's been over a week, I think, since we've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So, the further and further I get out from it, the less and less that bothers me, and more I just want to watch it again anyway.
Yeah.
So, my come-on moments are, like I said, they're kind of big picture, but at the same time, I feel like they're not that big of a deal.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, yeah. I'm willing to give up mine for everything else.
Yeah, so
that
so
I get back.
That's our bridge to ending on a positive note, which is our favorite moment. So, Josh, what were your favorite moments?
All right, like
think
I said
about this movie.
Like I said, I'm going to be a hypocrite because my least favorite moment was Fred, and my favorite moment is Fred.
Do explain.
Because there's three parts to this. The joke about his underwear is hilarious. And the second is that his dad is Stan Lee is awesome.
That's right.
And is one of my favorite parts. And then third is the combining of those two things when it all comes back in the end credit scene after all the credits are over, you know, and he discovers that his dad's a superhero and their connection is how they wear their underwear.
There you go.
And I just thought that was cool because I actually caught, you know, the cameo that it was Stan Lee in that portrait when they showed it quickly. And I was like, oh, it's Stan Lee. You know, like, I wonder if they'll just let that pass by, and they didn't, and made it pretty obvious. Like, he even voiced, you know, the part himself. But I just thought that was a cool Easter egg at the time, and it got even cooler as an end credit sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my favorite part, which, cool. You know, like I said, makes me a total hypocrite that Fred is my least and favorite part of this movie.
Such a paradox.
I'm gonna be obvious and say Baymax, and really in his relationship with Hero, and I mean, I love just the physical construction of this character is so unique and so unexpected, because he really is such a hero. I mean, he's the perfect hero, mm-hmm. and but he's so unlikely, you know, and you look at him and you think, what could you possibly do? How could you possibly protect me or do anything for me? But he, in taking care of Hero, he's very intelligent. He's very creative with how he, like, figures out how to help him and protect him. And of course, selfless. And so I love him. And I thought that Scott Adsit did an incredible job mm-hmm. voicing him. Of course, the way that he, you know, blah, blah, blah.
One of my favorite things. I was wondering when we were going to get around to doing that. Yeah. Because once my kids see this movie, I don't think I'm ever going to do the fist bump with them again. Yeah. Not like that. Because they'll always want to do that.
Yeah. And something else that I realized as I thought about their relationship is that Baymax is so pure and innocent, and in his interactions with, like, his pure way of seeing the world and seeing people, to me, it was just cool to watch how he was kind of mirroring or like showing to Hero the way that you could see the world that I think kind of was taken away from Hero because he had to grow up fast. He dealt with a lot of grief and loss and maybe didn't really have a childhood. And so it was kind of like he was seeing, you know, his brother who created Baymax and also himself in that too. You know, it was kind of giving him an opportunity to process through some of the things he wasn't able to have as a kid.
When you describe Baymax the way you've described him, mm-hmm. all that's coming to mind for some reason is Forrest Gump. Like, just someone who almost seems too simple to be the hero, mm-hmm. but sees the world different from everyone else and doesn't necessarily have the capacity to think critically, but that almost childlike thinking mm-hmm. allows him to completely be empathetic in a way, at a level that no one else can. Mm-hmm.
And see true things that mm-hmm. other people can't see because they've overcomplicated it.
Yeah, or they're lying to themselves mm-hmm. or they're misrepresenting something mm-hmm. because that's the way they want it to be, not the way it is. Mm-hmm. So maybe Tom Hanks should play the live action version of Baymax. Not really.
With that army cut.
Not really. Okay, so favorite moment. Fred made my list. Because, what is his name?
TJ Miller.
Yeah. TJ Miller, to me, it has a shtick. Mm-hmm. You know, in his movies, he has a shtick. And sometimes I think his shtick gets old quickly, and sometimes I think it can go on for a while. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really get tired of it because I felt like when it was supposed to feel like it was too much, the movie stopped and said, "Hey, that's too much," mm-hmm. because you know you had that line from Wasabi, who was like, you know, if you don't stop, I'm going to do the thing. So I think it was, you know, intentional, and I just love the way that he delivered his lines. You know, he's like, you know, by day I'm the school's mascot, and by night I'm still the mascot, you know, or whatever, you know, or just, I'm just a dude that loves science, you know, and he's like the
science, he represents, yeah,
exactly, like he represents the nerd fanboy mm-hmm. to all the real nerds,
yeah,
and I think there's a place for that, and I love that he's included,
yeah,
because I think you can be a nerd by being a scientist or by being a doctor, or by being an astronaut. But I think there's an incredible childlike awesomeness to just really loving it, even if you don't understand it. Mm-hmm. And that's Fred.
Yeah.
Fred's like, I tried to get him to make me an invisible sandwich, you know, so I could look like I'm eating a sandwich and everyone else would just think I'm crazy, you know, like he just loves it because it's, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
And I love that about Fred. I love most of the team in general. I love that Go-Go keeps saying, telling everyone to woman up, you know, regardless of their sex. But ultimately, I think, you know, one of my favorite things is Baymax. I think his humor carries a lot of this movie for me, just because it is just such a different way of interacting and looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just love how he takes something spectacular and almost oversimplifies it, and it's hilarious because besides when he was doing like the blah, 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 blah thing, like when he's like, flying makes me a better care provider, you know, and just that makes 100% sense, and it makes no sense at all. So I like I said, there's a lot of good stuff to this movie, and I'm actually pretty excited to see it again. Final thoughts, you know, I guess this is usually anything we missed, your recommendation, where would you land on this, Josh?
Yeah, I was going to say earlier that isn't it amazing how predictability disappears once you've seen the movie once and now you want to see it again, and predictability doesn't matter anymore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, yeah, I think the thing is like, I want to see this movie again, and I think that's the I think that's what's so great about it. You know, as much as it was, like we've said before, it was somewhat predictable and we were able to predict some of the major beats of the movie, at the end of the day, I still want to see it, which has to say something about how good the movie is, right? I mean, there's surprising complexity and depth to a movie that, like we said, is very simple, but simple's not a bad thing. And, you know, I think there's just a couple things in this movie that just really, really hit home well and just make the movie, like from the comedy from Baymax to the fact that it's technically amazing. Like, we don't even get really a chance to talk about the fact that we got to touch on it a little, that it's just, it's artistically and technologically incredible. And I don't really have anything. I don't think we really missed anything short of the fact that, I mean, that I'm going to see this movie again. I mean, not just because I want my kids to see it, but, you know, it's kind of one of those movies that it's going to wear it's just going to be, I'm going to see it a ton of times because my kids are going to want to see it again and again, and I'll watch it with them. It's the same thing like with Frozen or the Lego movie. It's just, it's got those moments in it that are memorable, and it's fun and exciting, and it's going to be something that I'm probably going to see and memorize a lot of the lines in the movie by like spring of next year. So,
well, and ultimately your kids going around like wanting to give you fist bumps and then going blah, 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 yeah, is way less annoying than all of them singing Let It Go all the time.
I don't know, my 4-year-old singing Let It Go is pretty darn cute. And even my 2-year-old who is just nice. No, she would do that. She's the sassy one. But you know, I think it's right up there with the Lego movie and just having some of those moments where I'm genuinely gonna laugh when my kids quote the movie. So yeah, it's, I hope that people who are listening have seen it already, but if you haven't, you need to go see it immediately, because even though we've spoiled the movie and it's incredibly predictable, it's still fun,
still,
and you'll see
it
100 times, and you'll have a Baymax toy after this Christmas.
That's right.
I want a Baymax toy after this Christmas.
I'm already trying to figure out where I can get one for
you.
Yeah,
no kidding.
I guess if I...
I want one for my shelf.
Yeah. I guess I... Maybe I don't have anything new to say, but I am thinking about a review from Real Spirituality that asked the question, which is more heroic, to harm or to heal? And I think this film does a great job of saying that even though peace and forgiveness is uncomfortable, it's painful, and you may not see the results from it, just reacting to pain with violence is only dealing with a symptom. But forgiveness and grace goes to the heart of the problem and actually causes transformation. And we saw that in that when they chose to forgive, they actually went to the heart of the problem, literally, and rescued Abigail for the person who was, you know, the villain, and reversed what caused all the pain and destruction in the first place. So, I think that's pretty remarkable for a movie with a big Marshmallow Man in it.
Well, so this is a cartoon or an animated film. I don't want to belittle it by calling it just a cartoon. This is an animated film, and like Laura pointed out earlier, even though that's what it'll be mostly saddled with, it's also very pro-science, pro-technology, and I'm hoping it does get people back, or kids, interested in science again. Mm-hmm. I feel when we reviewed Edge of Tomorrow, there we talked a great amount, or a great deal of time about the love of nice original sci-fi and how those stories are really important and how that genre doesn't get a lot of love. And I'm kind of happy to report that coming towards the end of this year, that, I mean, with movies like Snowpiercer to a certain degree, even though it's more post-apocalyptic or dystopia, depending on, like I said, it fits into a lot of categories. Edge of Tomorrow, Interstellar. I mean, earlier, technically last year, but more or less the beginning of this year, we had movies like Her. Some of the things that the Doctor Who dealt with this year in season 8 as a TV show about the need for exploration, the need to pursue science and knowledge and technology.
Not just for convenience sake, but for expansion, for, you know, creativity.
Yeah. And the role, and like I said, and the important role that creativity and how that kind of opens our minds, and it has the ability to bring us together and serve a very good purpose. And, you know, like I said, and definitely not in contradiction to any kind of religion or spirituality, but just because, you know, I feel like we've lost that spark, that desire to learn. And I hope that this movie kind of helped for a different subsection. Because, you know, I'm assuming that most of the kids that went to see this movie didn't go see Edge of Tomorrow. They're not seeing Interstellar, you know. They're not being encouraged to light that spark, you know. Like, when you ask kids what they want to be, they want to be, you know, they want to be famous. They don't even care why. They just want to be famous because that's what we worship. You know, we used to always, back in my day, you know, it was like you want to be an astronaut or you want to be a physicist. You know, like, that's the things I wanted to be when I was young because I love science, and I just want kids to love science again. You know, I want there to be some comparative love for knowledge that there is for being famous. And so, especially when, like I said, especially when you can really do a lot of good with it. So
you can be famous and an astronaut.
Exactly.
Nice.
Maybe not famous and a physicist. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, it depends. Like I said, it does depend. You can be famous and be an astrophysicist like Neil deGrasse Tyson. And, nice. You know, you can bridge both those gaps. But so anyway, I love that this movie kind of does incite that and is getting a lot of positive press because it does seem to have that niche to it. So with that, like I said, I feel like it's great for all ages. It's got a lot. It's just fun. No, I don't think it matters what your age is, you know, within reason of don't take your kid to the theater unless he sleeps with the movie.
Right.
Kind of, you know, subset. But great film. We all seem to really enjoy it. We would all highly recommend that you check it out if you haven't already. And heck, if you have, go see it again. Go find some more friends and go watch it again. Talk to your kids about it. Talk to someone else's kids about it. It's great. So I will always like to give my guests time to kind of self-promote a little bit because I'm really being empathetic to their ability to be on my show.
You're such a Baymax.
I'm so selfless. I mean, I'm like Baymax, but mostly in body type, not, you know, not emotional quotient. So if anyone needs to get warm, everyone's welcome to lean against me. But Josh, how can people find what you do and keep conversations going with you?
Well, there are really two wonderful places to find me. First, you can go to Real World Theology. You might have heard of it.
Oh, it sounds great.
It's wonderful. You should check it out. But I write there 4 times a week. I you know, just write kind of more of fun, engaging articles. At least I'd like to hope that they're engaging. You know, Tuesday through Friday. And working on some written reviews right now that are vexing me, but I will get them out. Hopefully by the time this podcast launches, I'll have 2 done for the site. And you can find me there. I'm writing there. And you can also find me on the wonderful Facebook for Movie Lovers, Letterboxd. You can find me there, Josh Crabb. That's my name. And there's actually a link, if you're not really familiar with Letterboxd, you can find the link to that actually on my little signature at the bottom of my posts on Real World Theology. So you can find me there. I'm on Twitter. At George Kreb is my Twitter handle. And, you know, that's basically the places you can find me on the internet. But mostly I'm doing all of my content stuff at Real World Theology.
What a good life decision that is for you.
it really has to prove to be a great life decision.
And it makes you a little bit of a liar, and I'm okay with that. So that's awesome. So I definitely check out Josh there. Personally, I would always check him out there. Anyone who would like to see what Laura's up to, Laura, how can people get a hold of you or keep conversation going with you?
They can check me out on Twitter. My handle is @Laura_Fissel, and they can go to my website, which is laurafissel.com. And I'd love for people to go there because I've been trying to post there more than anywhere else. I've really kind of stopped my personal blog just because of time. I try to post something every Thursday that inspires me as an artist. And I also put up quick book reviews of things that I'm audio listening to or reading. So that would be a great place. And I have a page there for my novel writing, for my copy editing, like various things that I do. So if you wanted to know more about any of that, you could find it there.
Cool. Well, you can find me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter. And if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, you've probably already visited our site, realworldtheology.com, because you all love Josh and you love what he does. So Continue to do that. Continue to be a fan of Josh's. And connect with us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on Stitcher. If you enjoy it, please, please, please comment on the show. Let's keep this conversation going. Review our show. We love 5-star reviews. It helps us kind of on iTunes and other rankings so people can find us, and then we can get more listener questions. We can get more ideas of the movies that you guys want to see, and everything gets mo better, yo.
Mm-hmm.
So while I think of that, I just wanted to thank you guys for taking the time to listen. I wanted to thank Josh and Laura again for taking the time to talk with me about this great movie.
You're so welcome.
And, you know, until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ba-la-la-la-la.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com. This would be way funnier if I could put any of this in the podcast.
Totally.
You always say that and then you end up putting stuff in anyway that you said you were going to edit out.